In our next case, 2023-0839, the State of Ohio versus Mario Mays. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Patatus. Good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice.
If I may, Joseph Patatus on behalf of Mr. Mays, if appropriate, I'd like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case, Your Honors, also revolves around the issue of statutory interpretation. However, I do not believe there is any hybrid interpretation necessary, that this should revolve around the mere plain language of 294575.
But even if we agree with you?
Even if you agree with me.
Was there plain error here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it proven?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, tell me how.
Okay, when we go to 294575 and we go back to this court's decision in State versus Pelfrey, we need to look at what the statute, the legislature, has required be present on any verdict form. When a offense can be enhanced or raised up a level based upon either an aggravating factor, such as a prior conviction, that must be stated either in form of felony level or form of the aggravating factor itself. And the plain error would be proven if we look at the notes, which I believe go back to 1977, the comments from the legislature regarding this code section. It uses the theft example. Previously in Ohio, a prior theft it would take it from a misdemeanor to a felony of the fourth degree, and the comments in the statute say unequivocally that if that is not present, that secondary theft, that subsequent theft, is now a misdemeanor of the first degree. Domestic violence is another example of that we commonly encounter in our cases. You're charged with the physical harm to a family or household member, but you have a prior domestic violence, which then is either typically seen as either a further finding, we do find that there is a prior, or it simply states on the verdict form a felony of the fourth degree, if it's going from the M1 to the F4. Here, 29-19-27A is a misdemeanor of the first degree. That's the plain language of that statute as well. It can be enhanced to a felony of the fifth degree if one of the factors in subsection B3 are found. Here, though, we don't know which factor was found. There's no finding made by the jury to say, was this B3A, B, or was it C? And that's why I think the government's argument fails, is first, under the plain language of 294575, there is nothing that says the insertion of the statute is sufficient to establish the degree of the felony. The legislature is clear. It's one of two things, either the aggravating factor, such as a prior conviction, or putting the level of the felony on the verdict form itself. It does not say inclusion of statutory language. And I think when we look at the legislative comments, it's a common sense, it's a simplistic reason. Some of these statutes are 13 subsections deep. Failure to comply is one of those sections. Drugs is one of those sections that can go multiple layers deep. OVI has, I believe it goes into the triple J's. The legislature unequivocally said aggravating factor or level of the offense. And that's an easy task to do. That's not asking trial courts to perform a high level function. It's simply saying on the verdict form, this is what the jury is finding.
Should we even get into the discussion of plain error? Because Criminal Rule 52 and the Quarterman case indicate that the accused has to bear the burden to demonstrate plain error on the record. But then we have other case law that says that the aggrieved party, a party who benefits from an error, cannot be the party aggrieved. So it would be the state who would have had to have actually pointed out the deficiency, and it would be the state that would need to be arguing that the outcome would be different.
I do agree with that, Your Honor, but I guess I am bound by the prior cases, whether it's Pelfrey, whether it's McDonald, whether it's Eford, and those cases were all analyzed under the plain error standard. I do agree with you, though, that this is something the state of Ohio should have raised at the time. They should have observed, they should have viewed the verdict form, noticed that the verdict form was not in compliance with 294575, and they should have brought this to the court's attention. I do agree with you, Your Honor, but when I look at Pelfrey and all the subsequent cases after that have been under the plain error analysis, well, they have also found that this is plain error. that there is no question from prior analysis, and I don't believe the government's challenging it, that this, the plain error would be found here if this court says that this does not comply with 294575. But I do agree, and I do appreciate the question, I agree. I think the government was required to raise this at the trial level. They did not. They should not now be able to argue that this language was sufficient. The Sixth District, in analyzing this, and I believe Judge Zmuda did a great job in his analysis.
Wait a second. This is supposed to be a protection for your clients. So why wasn't your client's obligation to raise it?
And that's where we go into Pelphrey, Your Honor. In Pelphrey, this is plain error. There is no obligation for the defendant to raise it under Pelphrey or McDonald.
So that's where you get to plain error, is when the defendant has an obligation to raise something and doesn't raise it. That's what makes it plain error standard.
Correct. So, Your Honor, here it was not raised by either party. And when we do the analysis from the perspective of the defense following the Pelphrey analysis, it is still plain error because it's noncompliance with a statute that requires a court document to be produced, recorded, and documented in this very specific way.
But that's not the plain error standard. The plain error standard, if you look at the, doesn't say that. It says that affects substantial rights, and that's been taken to mean that it prejudices your client.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So how is your client prejudiced by this error?
Absolutely. When we go through the constitutional analysis, whether it's the U.S. Constitution or our own Ohio Constitution, and I know the government cites to it in their brief, in Ohio, a defendant has the right to have his verdict form accurately reflect the charges upon which he was convicted.
But that's the error.
Yes.
The prejudice has to be that the result would be different. How would the result of the trial have been different if the verdict form had specifically stated the level of the offense?
Your Honor, and with respect, I think this goes back to Pelphrey, and the question is sort of reversed. Was he convicted of a felony? And the answer to that question is no, he was not convicted of a felony, because the verdict form fails to comply with 294575. So how would the outcome be different, Your Honor? The outcome has been different because he's been convicted of an offense which has not complied with either the constitutional requirements of the state or the statutory requirements that the legislature has espoused happened. So that is how he has been deprived of a substantial right, because his verdict form does not reflect a felony conviction that the court now says he has been convicted of.
But isn't 29.19.27b3 that felony?
That subsection is a felony, yes, Your Honor.
And wasn't that stated in the form?
That was on the form, Your Honor. But, Your Honor, where that's different is that goes back to the plain language of 294575. And there's two questions that, and I know it's not appropriate for me to ask a question back to the court, but hypothetically, Your Honor, which subsection was he convicted on? Because there are three subsections there, each of which is a varying degree.
If it said, it made reference to 29.19.27b3a, little 2, or little I, small g, very specific, then would this be okay?
No, Your Honor.
Because the statute does not.
Statute, and where I believe, Your Honor, that line of questioning is coming from is the concurrence in McDonald. And I think the concurrence in McDonald is being misstated by the government. I don't believe it's being intentionally misstated, but I believe it's being misstated in the sense that Judge Lajzinger in the concurrence does not say that that would be enough. Judge Lazinger's concurrence is, I believe, saying the opposite, is now we are requiring more elements go on to the verdict form. Because in McDonald, the verdict form said that McDonald was found, we the jury being duly imposed, the panel do find McDonald guilty of operating a vehicle that caused substantial risk of physical harm, and they left out the word willful. And that is why in McDonald, this court reversed, finding that the willful portion was what was left out that didn't elevate it up to, I believe it was a felony of the third degree in that case. So I think when we talk about that concurrence I think is actually saying that now, as a result of the McDonald case, we need to have all of those aggravating factors on the verdict form or the level of the offense. And again, that's a simple task to complete. It's simply saying this is a felony of the fourth degree felony of the fifth degree we would not be here today. And I think that's where Judge Zmuda gets it right in his dissent, is that when we look at this, there are no aggravating factors on the verdict form itself, and there is no felony level. Seeing no further questions, I'd yield the remainder of my time and come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Jarrett, here on behalf of the state of Ohio. It says here that you are going to share time with Mr. Peterson from the Attorney General's office.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'll be reserving 5 minutes of my time.
For him?
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Evie Jarrett, appearing on behalf of the Lucas County Prosecutor. This case does, as the appellant indicated, involve two questions. One is the question of the reading of the statute. And the second is, what review do we apply when that error that's complained of now for the first time on appeal was not raised in the trial court when there
was— Does the state concede that the statute wasn't followed?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The statutory reference pointed to only one felony level. The statutory reference was specific. It provided the fifth degree felony, and that's the only felony level that this offense could take. So our view is that this offense, the commission of a violation of a protective order when one had already previously been committed, that's a felony of the fifth degree. That's all it can ever be. And it's worth noting that this particular case did not involve any kind of lesser included instruction or jury verdict form. This case was one where if the jury found that the aggravating factor wasn't present, he would have been acquitted. That's not at all what happened. And that would be, I think, feeding into the analysis of whether plain error occurred. I guess I would respectfully disagree with the reading of the Pelfrey, Eford, and McDonald trilogy as all applying a plain error standard. From my reading of it, the only one of those three that applied the plain error would be the Eford case. The remaining two cases, the split between the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion was actually the question of, shouldn't we be applying plain error to these cases? The defendant has the opportunity to object. If his rights are going to be prejudiced, he can object and he can resolve that issue in the trial court rather than raising it for the first time on appeal. And I believe that Justice O'Donnell identified three points at which these can be raised in the trial court. You could raise them when the jury verdict is first read. You could raise them at sentencing. You can raise it when the jury verdict is tendered to the jury before they actually retire for deliberations. When you fail to hit one of those points, then plain error should be applied. And as Justice DeWine pointed out, that's a pretty high bar to meet. In those kinds of cases, we have to see not only some deviation from the statutory mandate, again, without conceding that that deviation occurred, but you have to identify the error, and you have to show that substantial rights were implicated. You have to show that in some way the outcome of the proceeding was affected. And it's very, very hard on any record similar to this case to identify that.
And this do we look at, when we say the outcome would have been different, meaning he would have been found not guilty?
So yes, I do believe that this is distinct from the kind of analysis that this court went through in the Bond majority opinion, where the court was examining whether there are kinds of public policy implications of a particular constitutional right that may not affect the outcome of the proceeding, but may still be so worth preserving to us as a society that we're going to say that it's automatically reversible. This kind of requirement that is essentially a record-keeping requirement designed to allow the defendant to say that he was convicted of the offense that he was charged with, and to allow the reviewing court to assess whether that actually occurred the way it was supposed to, that's not the kind of constitutional right that is so fundamental to the system that we recognize it as being a structural error.
But I want to point out from Pelfrey, and we stated specifically, we hold that the clear language of 2945.75 requires that a verdict form signed by a jury must include either the degree of the offense of which the defendant is convicted or a statement that an aggravating element has been found to justify convicting a defendant of the greater degree of a criminal offense. So if we already held that this is the language and that it's clear and that it has to happen, do you want us to overrule Pelfrey?
I think that you don't have to overrule Pelfrey. We've got a circumstance that is very different from Pelfrey. We have the identification of a statutory provision that has only one offense. The very beginning of the statute that we're talking about today actually states that it kicks in when the presence of one or more additional elements makes the offense one of a more serious degree.
Number three has A, B, and C. It has three different options. And if the statute says that the jury has to notify the defendant through the verdict form what exactly he did wrong, why do we have the authority to change that?
So I think there are a couple different things that are going on with the statute. And one is the disjunctive use of the word or. We have either to say a felony level, which we satisfy by identifying a particular version, a particular provision of the statute that has one unique felony level, or we can identify the sort of aggravating, elevating factors that would increase the applicable offense level. So in this particular case, we have identified a specific provision that is tied to one particular felony level. So we satisfy that disjunctive part. There is nothing constitutional that requires a jury verdict form to identify precisely what theory is pursued.
But you're not the appellant challenging the constitutionality of the statute. Mr. Mays is.
Yes. We're not contesting the constitutionality of the statute. What we're contesting is the...
I misspoke. He's not contesting the constitutionality statute, but he's appealing.
Right. What I would say in response to that is that we safeguard the constitutional rights by allowing the jury verdict form, which complies with the very basic constitutional guarantees. There's nothing that says the state has to provide exactly the subsection in order to identify the theory of prosecution.
But how do we know the legislature isn't saying we want it specific here because we think that these kinds of violations with protection orders, that maybe the defendant should learn exactly what he did so maybe he won't do it again once he's punished?
So again, I go back to the disjunction, the use of the word or. We can satisfy the statutory mandate by looking at the felony level as opposed to exactly what's happening.
It says any of the following. It doesn't say or.
The jury verdict statutory form is the statute I was referring to.
Thank you.
So it says the verdict form is satisfactory if it identifies either the elevated level of the offense or the factors that caused that elevation. So when we have a specific reference that is tied to a specific level, it's the state's position that we satisfy that. I hope that answered your question.
Okay.
With respect to plain error, I would again ask that the court review and apply the plain error standard that was followed in Eford, and many of the similarities apply in this case. We have an indictment that specified exactly what the elevating offense was. We have jury instructions that were very clear, enumerated the four elements that the trial court required, and specifically identified the precise kind of protection order that had previously been violated. And we have a conviction that aligns with both of those things. when those are considered, I think there's no alternative but to say that there was absolutely no prejudice to the defendant in this case. And I would yield the rest of my time to Mr. Peterson.
I do have one more question for you. We had McDonald, then we had Eford, then we had Pelfrey. And in Pelfrey, in McDonald, sorry, when we had Pelfrey, Eford, McDonald, didn't we reiterate Pelfrey and McDonald? So isn't Eford just kind of an anomaly out there?
I think that the format is very key to the jury verdict form. Here we have the reference to that limited statutory number, and that was not the case in either McDonald or Pelfrey. And we do, of course, have a concurring opinion that says, yep, if this jury verdict had actually included the specific provision that was being indicted under, it would have been completely satisfactory.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Peterson.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. No one can dispute that the jury in this case found that Mays had committed a fifth-degree felony. Mays seeks to avoid the consequences of that jury's finding, but the court should reject his attack on the jury's verdict for two reasons. First, the verdict form in this case complied with the verdict provision of Revised Code 2945.75b, and second, even if the court disagrees, any error was harmless. If I could, I'd like to make probably 2 points about why this jury verdict form complied with the statute and 2 points about harmless error. And I'll begin with why this complied. Now, I understand my colleague this morning, he cited the comments to Revised Code 2945.75 from 1974. But the thing about that is at the time those comments were written, the controlling decision interpreting that statute would have been State v. Park from 1962, which dealt with larceny and the degree of the value of property that was stolen, and that would affect the degree of the offense. And so statute in Park addressed that. And the court there said, it is enough to cite the indictment that would list the value, and you don't have to put that into the verdict form itself. And so at the time those comments were written.
Is there language? Oh, okay, I'm sorry, keep on going.
So at the time that those comments were written, they were before Pelfrey, and Pelfrey never dealt with Park, which is one of the reasons why we think it's wrongly decided. But those comments do not help Mays in this case, because if anything, they show that a verdict form and the statute at the time could have interpreted, sort of could have incorporated other things, and it didn't need to use the specific words X degree felony. And I wanted to make a second point about the violation of protective order statute, and he was found guilty of violating 2919.27B3. B3 is always a fifth degree felony. Yes, it has three different ways of committing that fifth degree felony, but I don't think there would have been any dispute, and this is the point the Sixth District made, if the verdict form in this case said Mays had committed a fifth degree felony, it still wouldn't have listed those alternative avenues. And so that's really a red herring that the verdict form didn't address them, because
couldn't the legislature have, I want to ask you the same question I asked your co-counsel, couldn't the legislature have wanted to put the defendant on notice of why he was being convicted of a felony specifically as sort of a deterrent for the future to curb that conduct? I mean, how can we say that if the language is there and says this is what's required, that it's not really, it was good enough just to do?
Certainly the General Assembly could have done that, but they didn't.
No, but why wouldn't that be a policy reason that the General Assembly had that? Wouldn't that be?
And they absolutely could have had that policy reason, but if they had that policy reason, they wouldn't have given two alternatives. They wouldn't have said either list the degree of the offense or the additional elements. They would have only said list the additional elements. Here, they gave two alternatives.
But that doesn't tell you in its language that it's the degree of the offense. This just says this is what the offense is, and you have to go someplace else to find that it's a felony.
But again,
am I correct?
You are correct. You have to look up the statute, but the statute is always going to be a fifth degree felony. But that turns to, so even if the court disagrees on what if the verdict form needed to say, if the court believes it needed to say use the words fifth degree felony, any error was harmless. I'd like to make 2 points about harmless error. First is that is the standard that this court applies to Sixth Amendment jury trial violations. I know my colleague discussed the Sixth Amendment and the notice, the make sure that the jury finds all the relevant facts.
Well, why wouldn't this be plain error, not harmless error? They didn't object, so it should be a plain error standard, shouldn't it?
I agree with Your Honor that plain error would be appropriate, and I think that if the court agrees, we don't take any issue with that. We're offering harmless error as an alternative because it was never addressed in any of the court's prior decisions.
Well, let's say we don't agree with your position. I'll say whether it's plain error or in any event, the statute says what the verdict form has to require. Why is this harmless? Because what happens?
So under a harmless error standard, I think there's two possible avenues. Here, where you look at the four corners of the jury verdict form, and it is clear from those four corners of the form what the degree of the felony is, you can't say that the defendant was in any way prejudiced. The jury made the necessary findings. No one can dispute looking at that form that it was a fifth-degree felony. Now, I think a tougher case would be if the form was ambiguous. Now, under the Sixth Amendment, under a jury trial right, you could look to things like the jury instructions, you could look to the evidence presented at trial. And here, if you do that, the jury instructions clearly specified which of the violation of protective order alternatives.
So let's say we reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. We don't find that it was harmless error. What happens?
Well, I think under my colleague's theory, if you find that the verdict form needed to use the word fifth-degree felony, and if you find neither plain error applies nor harmless error applies, I think that the you would have to find that he had been convicted only of a misdemeanor. We don't think that's appropriate because no one, Mays has never argued that the jury didn't find him guilty of a fifth-degree felony as a factual matter. I think no one can dispute that. And so it really elevates form over substance and allows the defendant to evade what the jury actually found.
Were the jury instructions in writing?
The jury instructions were in writing. If you look at page 334 to 335 of the transcript, that's when the judge reads the instructions to the jury. I can't specifically tell you I know what form they went to the jury in, but you can look in the transcript and you can see those jury instructions. And clearly, the jury was instructed on only one of the 2919.27B3 alternatives. And so there's no dispute, no question, if you look at the jury instructions, what the jury was instructed
and
on.
And what about that it was a fifth-degree felony? Did that go into the instructions?
It did not go into the instructions, and we wouldn't want it to. The jury is tasked with finding the facts relevant to a conviction. They're not supposed to be thinking about punishment or a possible sentence. We want the jury to be focused only on the facts. And if you look at 2945.75, it also talks about either the degree of offense or the elements. The jury is focused on the elements. The degree is not something we want the jury considering.
That's the or that your co-counsel was focusing on, correct?
I'm sorry?
That's the or that your co-counsel was focusing
on? Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
So I want to make sure that I understood what you said, because I heard something different from your friend on your side. You say that if I look at the four corners of the verdict form, it complies with the statute, I need not go any further. But what I heard her say is I have to take in consideration all of these other things, like the jury instructions. So I have to go beyond the four corners of the document. So which is it?
I think we're saying the same things. I think she would agree with me that if you look at the four corners, it says he violated 2919.27B3. B3 is always a fifth-degree felony. Now, I think if you go beyond the four corners, and this is what she was saying, if you look at the jury instructions, if you look at these other things, that further buttresses the fact that there is either no prejudice, so no plain error where the burden is on the defendant, no prejudice under harmless error where the burden is on the state. That's really the difference in large part, the difference between plain error and harmless error, who bears the burden. And so I think what you're saying is if you look at the statute, you look at the verdict form, no one can dispute what the jury found here. And if you look at the other additional elements, that just further buttresses that there's no prejudice. So we would ask the court to affirm the Sixth District and to resolve the certified conflict in this case by holding that this verdict form complied with Revised Code 2945.75B. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Patatus, you have 5 minutes, 39 seconds.
Most time I've ever had, Your Honor.
I have a starting question from what your colleague on the other side said. If we reverse.
Yes.
And find error, harmless or plain, does your client walk or is it a misdemeanor?
It's a misdemeanor of the first degree, Your Honor.
Why?
Because the reversal would have found that the lowest form of the offense would be a misdemeanor of the first degree.
So you agree with your colleague that it is then a misdemeanor?
Oh, absolutely. This is not going to be result in an acquittal or something of that nature, or even a new trial. This is simply he should be held accountable and responsible for what that verdict form says.
But what about what Mr. Peterson said? Your client has never said he did not commit the higher offense.
Well, that's simply not accurate, Your Honor. We wouldn't be standing here if that was the case. This has been challenged from the Sixth District, Judge Zamuda's dissent. This is also a conflict case, which is where I wanted to lead in. We absolutely are challenging whether or not he's been convicted of a felony of the fifth degree. This is a conflict case, and we're here to try to bring about an end to the confusion that, and I think it's Eford is the one that causes the confusion. If we go simply to the plain language of 2945-75, trial courts should be instructed, and I have the benefit of trying cases all across the state. It's common for a jury to be told on the verdict form, this is a felony of the third degree. I just tried a homicide in Seneca County. The jury was told, this is a felony of the third degree. It's not an uncommon practice. It's not a difficult practice. And going back to the plain error, and sometimes under questioning, I go blank for no reason. It's Apprendi. This is an Apprendi problem. This is an element of an offense that raises it from a lower level to a higher level. A defendant has the constitutional right under Apprendi to have the jury find him guilty or her guilty of that element. And here, the defendant, Mr. Mays, is not even placed on notice in the verdict form of what.
But 29-1927B3, even though it doesn't say what subsection of B3, but if all of the subsections are felony of fifth degree, then.
Your Honor, again, I know I'm not supposed to ask hypothetical back. It's which subsection, though, has he been convicted of? In going back to the statutory interpretation following Parks, Parks was in that 1968 case. In 1977, our legislature said we're moving away from Parks, and this is what we want our verdict forms to say. And I think it's for this reason. The defendant has the right to know what it is he has been convicted of. And it has to state in plain language. And this is one of the few statutes I get to argue that are not ambiguous, they're not confusing. The only path to a felony conviction in this case was to go through the misdemeanor section.
Well, yes, but we're saying, so if B3, all the subsections are fifth degree felonies, he definitely has noticed that he's been convicted of a fifth degree felony.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I disagree with that because which subsection?
Does the subsection matter for degree?
The degree, I think, would matter because that's.
But isn't all of B3 fifth degree felonies?
All of B3 are fifth degree felonies. B3 A through C are fifth degree felonies. Absolutely.
With this jury verdict form, I mean, isn't it possible that the legislature felt that for protection order cases where it can be a matter of he said, she said, that, or he said, however it works, but isn't it possible that the legislature wanted the jury to, number one, understand when it was signing that verdict form that this is a felony if it's a B3 case, and or that it's for this particular action that we're convicting you, and not just putting a code section in there that really generally means almost nothing to a layperson?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that goes to Judge Stewart's, what the discussion we're having over here is that a defendant has the absolute right to be put on notice of what he has been convicted of.
But I'm talking about the jury, too.
And I do think that a jury has to be instructed properly as to what it is they're convicting somebody of. And when they sign their names, in this case 12 people, signing their names to a piece of paper saying we find him guilty, they should be aware of what they're finding somebody guilty of. And here, simply saying here is a subsection B, not informing the jury that there are multiple subsections under Apprendi, there is a failure to have that specific fact found beyond a reasonable doubt.
But how does that make sense when, if they had just said fifth degree felony, it would have been perfectly fine. You can't argue with that, right?
I agree. That would
and that wouldn't have told you what subsection.
That's why under 2945-75, Your Honor, the clear language of the legislature says either the felony level or the facts.
Okay, but you just you've been on this that he's entitled to the right to know which subsection. This is why we have to have this. But clearly, no one would dispute if the jury said fifth degree felony without specifying what subsection, it wouldn't matter.
And then, Your Honor, in that case, I would agree. But that's why we're talking about the two sides of the disjunctive. If we're going to go with facts and we're going to go with facts that elevate it, we need to be precise in the facts that elevate it.
So those facts elevated would more align with the argument that the B3 subsections need to be set forth. But if you just say fifth degree felony or the degree of the felony, it doesn't list, instead of the facts, it doesn't line up with the subsections.
That's yes, Your Honor. So if we're talking about aggravating facts, whether in this case a prior conviction, mm-hmm. we need to say it's the prior conviction, which right. is what we do in domestic violence cases all the time, drug cases with weight all the time. Those aggravating factors need to be clearly spelled out on the verdict form.
But if you just say the degree of felony, then...
If we're just saying degree of felony, not the statute section, simply say the degree of felony. This code 2945, and I see that I'm out of time, 2945.75 says... degree of felony or aggravating facts. It does not say list a code section.
Right.
Because
but what is saying the degree of felony do for, how does that help your argument that the defendant needs to know what he's convicted of?
Is he convicted of a misdemeanor, which is what the statute is? Because under McDonald, the only path to a felony in this case would be through that misdemeanor first. So as it relates to that code section, the reason why the code section is so important, that takes you outside of the indictment, that takes you, sorry, outside of the verdict form. And in Pelfrey and in McDonald, we are clear. You only go to the verdict form. So to go to a subsection of a code that takes you outside of what is on that verdict form. And to end the conflict in these districts, the 8th District came out contrary to my argument here in State versus Shetner, just in full disclosure. 6th District is contrary right now. Every other district, though, would agree that the plain language of the statute agrees. So I believe to end the conflict, simply eliminate Eford or say that Eford has been abrogated by McDonald and just require the plain language of the statute to be applied. Thank you.
Thank you. Marshal, please call a recess. We'll take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision.
All rise.